The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Thank you. How's the volume? Can you hear if I speak like this? Pretty well? Okay, even in the back. Very good. So, good morning. I recently read an article called The Psychology of Lost. And it's mainly about that, about being lost in the woods, actually. And it actually looks at what happens in people's minds and their behavior when they perceive that they are lost. So as I read it, of course, I thought, this can be seen as an analogy for spiritual practice. And that's how I'd like to approach today's talk. There are at least two ways that we can feel lost spiritually. Of course, in our lives, we may have a sense of not knowing our purpose or what's meaningful or what we should be doing. And then also, if one has a meditation practice, we can get lost in the territory of our mind and not know what's happening in our sitting or how to do our practice on the cushion. I think over time I've seen that these are not as different as they sound, these two different kinds of being lost. So the proposed contrast to the state of being lost is to have a path, to have a way of navigating, of orienting. And actually the Buddha said this himself. He said that he had found an ancient path. This is a quote from the Discourses. I saw an ancient path, an ancient road, traveled by the rightly self-awakened ones of former times. And what is that ancient path, that ancient road, traveled by the rightly self-awakened ones of former times? Just this noble eightfold path, right view, right resolve, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. I followed that path. Following it, I came to direct knowledge of, and he lists various things, but essentially it's direct knowledge of the Four Noble Truths. So the Buddha, too, used the analogy of being in the woods and finding a path. And interestingly, as it says in this quote, what he found was something that was, in a sense, already there. The Dhamma is built into the universe, the way a path is kind of there, etched in the forest somehow. And we can find this path also because the Buddha offered us teachings for finding and walking it. So today we're going to use some of the ideas from this article, The Psychology of Lost, to look at being lost and at finding and traveling the path, especially certain elements of the Eightfold Path. So first of all, we have to ask, what is being lost? And according to the article, being lost has two components. One is that a person is unable to determine their current position with respect to other known locations. And then the second is to have no effective means of reorienting. So probably many of us know this feeling, physically or spiritually. There was perhaps a time, I don't know about in the woods, but, where you got turned around in the shopping mall and suddenly you had no idea where your partner was and you had no idea how you'd gotten to this floor because they had led you there. Whoa. Of course, now we have cell phones, but you get the analogy. So note that there are actually these two components, not knowing where you are and having no way of reorienting. So it's true that even if we don't know exactly where we are, we're not really in trouble if we have a means of reorienting. So that could be a map that we're able to read. It could be a person with us who can guide us. Or it could be cues in the environment, some method that we've learned about how to orient. And all of these have analogies in the spiritual life also. So in the Buddhist spiritual life, we are on a journey through our heart and our mind, and hence the world and our life. but it's a long-term transformational process. And it's reasonable to expect that there will be periods where we don't quite know where we are. This is actually totally normal on the Buddhist spiritual path, or any path, really. And similarly, there are periods where we do know clearly what's going on, and those are normal too, just to normalize those different periods. And it's not like you're lost for a while and then you figure it out and that's it for a while. It kind of goes back and forth, I'm sorry to say. But spiritual training takes as its foundation the notion that we can learn how to orient, yeah? So that we're no longer lost in a fundamental sense. We don't know where we are necessarily, but we have some way of finding a path, finding our path again. So in Buddhist training, we call that right view. Okay, right view, or our view, is the orientation that we're using in our life and in our practice, something that we can keep returning to as an anchor or a guidepost. There's a sutta that says, in several places during the sutta, kind of repeats it, right view is the forerunner, and what it's the forerunner to is all the other steps of the path. So, for example, one important view that we can use to orient is the understanding that actions that we do have results, and that we can have some choice about that. So, for example, actions that do harm in the world will bring us suffering, and actions that don't harm will bring us peace. That's kind of the reaction, the response in our own mind. And so even if we don't have an idea of the larger picture of what we're doing or what the meaning of our life is right now or anything, we can still choose to do a non-harmful action in this moment. And that can be a guide, you know, from step by step. And people can actually feel great relief and great peace at just knowing that this guide exists of choosing a non-harmful action. I have certainly felt that in my own life. And I know there have been times that Gil has said that he was happy just to have a path, you know, just to feel, okay, I have, you know, there's something I can use. Another way to orient is to notice the suffering or the stress in a particular situation. So when we realize that something is amiss or out of alignment, we can tune right into that feeling of being lost or of being stressed or of struggling in some way. And then we can sense, by actually turning toward and allowing that feeling to be there, we can begin to sense where the contours are that move us out of that or away from that. We move from a state of suffering toward balance, toward non-suffering. And this is an example of using the Noble Truths as a guide, so using the possibility of sensing suffering and its end as a guide. I think about sometimes with this topic the flow of my own life, actually, in that I had originally an orientation in my life that was to pursue being a scientist. This was my early education. And I was really interested in it, and I was devoted to it. And I felt resonant with the values and the ideas of the scientific approach. But interestingly, not by any choice of my own, there came a point where that wasn't quite right for me. It wasn't quite enough for me, in some sense. There was something missing from that that view, I would say. But I didn't have a very clear sense of that. That process wasn't clear to me at the time. And I actually let go of that original orientation without picking up another one right away. And I kind of wandered for a few years without a lot of direction and without a clear refuge. And it didn't serve me well. You know, it was actually, I remember that as kind of a disoriented time in my life. And fortunately then I found the Dharma. And that provided a much better path, a much better orientation. But I can really see now, looking back, the difference between having some kind of a means of orienting and not. Yeah, so I'm very grateful for that transition. And yet, it's not quite enough just to orient. You know, if you think of orienting, it's like turning in a certain direction and knowing which way you're facing. We then actually have to act on our understanding, and we have to actually locate and walk on the path. So in the case of the woods, and maybe in the case of the spiritual life, we can call this wayfinding. And so there's some things in this article about what makes a good wayfinder and, you know, how people do orient when trying to get out of the woods, when they've wandered off the path and don't know which way to get back. So wayfinding competence in the woods is determined by a person's ability to attend to the appropriate environmental stimuli, such as landmarks, indicating a change of direction along a route, and the ability to remember the course of the routes that they've traveled. Yeah? So you have to kind of have a sense of looking around in the environment and seeing the cues, and then remembering as you're navigating through those. And on the spiritual path, I would say attending is also the key, especially in our practice. You know, we have the practice of noticing things, of paying attention. So the skills of mindfulness and appropriate attention came to mind for me. So often we become lost in our lives by becoming overcome by emotions or unruly thoughts or concerns. This may sound familiar. And this is often because we've succumbed to what's called inappropriate attention, basically, or careless attention. So this kind of attending to things and allowing them to build and run and get stronger when they're not serving us, that's actually the main cause of having the five hindrances in our mind. These hindrances are sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and remorse, and doubt, the things that plague the mind and keep it from being able to settle, being able to be clear, being able to orient, and being able to find the way. And then indeed, psychologically, being lost tends to be associated with a mental state of high arousal. So people who are lost in the woods are generally not calm, cool, and collected, at least right at the beginning, right? Often this comes in the form of fear, this arousal. And, you know, there's studies of states of arousal of the mind and how effective the mind is. And usually it's this kind of U-shaped curve. If there's not enough arousal, then we're falling asleep and zoning out. And if there's too much, then the mind is too agitated and not able to make good decisions, essentially. Fear interferes with making good decisions. So we lose clarity of intention. We lose clarity of action. So mindfulness is the counteraction to a scattered and distracted and aroused mind. And we've seen that, I know, on the cushion. We can't always do it, but the times when we're able to attend, even if the mind is aroused, is worried about something, if we can step back and see that, I see worry. Right there at that moment, already the mind is in a calmer state than when it was just identified with, grabbed onto the worry, and that was all that it knew, all it could do. Yeah? So mindfulness, we need mindfulness just as the basis for being able to find the way. And the good news is that mindfulness can be trained. That's what we do, you know, that's what we do here. So furthermore, we're not just generally attentive. This article about the woods points out that we're supposed to pay attention to what? To landmarks and to our course along the route traveled. Okay, so you can get this immediately in the woods. You know, we have to watch the trees and the slope of the ground and where the streams are and these kind of things so that we have some sense of what direction we're going in and where we are relative to the mountain that we thought we were climbing and things like that. So in Buddhist practice, maybe the analogy that we're offered is the four foundations of mindfulness. Yeah, there are realms that are relevant for us to pay attention to if we're to advance on the path, the Buddhist path. So these four foundations of mindfulness are the body, feeling tone, mind states, you know, how the mind is, and what's called dhammas or dharmas, which is a little bit more about patterns of experience, or the way different qualities of the mind interact. So the body is an excellent landmark to use because it's always in the present moment. Yeah, so the feelings of the breath, of sitting, of the contact points on the cushion. I often use these in my practice as ways of reorienting the mind that has wandered off on some track of thinking, all right, come back, or just allow the body to reappear in awareness. It's an excellent means of orientation, and it can be a landmark in so many other ways too. There's a huge amount of information in the body. Emotions that we have tend to change the way we breathe, they tend to change the way the body feels, they change the flow of the energy through the body. As we start to tune into this, we can actually learn a lot about what's going on in our mind and our mental landscape. For many people, the body is actually a clearer, clearer indicator than trying to figure out what's going on in the mind. It's too easy to get sucked into the story and the views and the thoughts that are going on. Whereas if you just notice, oh, you know what, I'm feeling that fluttering in my belly, I bet there's a lot of fear, I bet there's anxiety going on. Or, you know, I'm feeling burning in my chest, anger, before you snap at someone. And then the second foundation, the feeling tone, this refers not so much to our feelings, like our emotions, but to whether experience is pleasant or unpleasant, or not really either pleasant or unpleasant. And we can often say at first, well, that doesn't sound that important. But actually, this one is critically important. And maybe I should say I felt at first this didn't sound as important. But I've learned over time that actually the mind is kind of poised on a slope that goes in either direction. And when something is pleasant or feeling good at that moment, there's the possibility of grabbing onto that and wanting it or wanting to hold it or trying to keep it. Whereas when it feels a little more on the unpleasant, not so sure about this, then there can be a tendency to push it away, to start formulating philosophies about why this is wrong and bad and shouldn't happen, you know. And so, but that very first point is where we notice that something is pleasant or unpleasant. It's actually the point where we can stop that slippery slope from happening. Definitely these are ways that the mind gets lost. And then the third foundation, the mind states, is more the realm of thinking, of emotion, of intentional actions of the mind. And it's also the realm of our general mood. You know, kind of you wake up one morning and you're feeling grumpy. And, you know, through no conscious desire of your own, but because of this, then you notice everything that's wrong in the kitchen when you walk in. And so by tuning in to, oh, you know what, I'm just feeling a little grumpy right now, we cannot get lost in the specifics of what we're seeing, because we're aware that our mind is just going to pick out the parts that don't look as pleasant, that aren't as, that don't seem to be right. Yeah, so being aware of kind of what state the mind is in at this moment is really useful. And then a little bit more refined, we can notice if there's some obscurity of what we're seeing, like the mind's a little foggy, not seeing too clearly, or the mind is very sharp and has a lot of clarity right now, or the mind is feeling sticky, it's grabbing onto things, or the mind is relatively free, it's able to let go fairly easily, life feels kind of light. These are good things to know about how the mind is in a given moment and can, again, prevent us from getting lost, from getting disoriented through the coloration that the mind is adding. And then the fourth foundation, the Dhammas, I won't go into much. It's a more expanded view that helps us see patterns of things arising in the mind. So when we're familiar with the landmarks of how our mind and body are, then we can begin to navigate and choose specifically the activities and the direction to go that's going to be nourishing and that's going to allow things that are unwholesome to fall away and allow things that are wholesome to grow and be maintained. These are the activities of right effort. Yeah, so this is the another step on the path that comes about through using this wayfinding example. So regarding geographical wayfinding, this article pointed out that there's a distinction between two different kinds of knowledge, which I found actually interesting and useful. One is what's called survey knowledge, and this is something like imagining that you're hovering over a territory and you can see sort of a topological map of it, and it's sort of cognitive. So you have a sense of, you know, this peak is 3 miles from that valley and these things are relatively oriented. And then there's also, in contrast, there's root knowledge, and R-O-U-T-E, knowledge of the roots. And this is sort of experiential knowledge of how to traverse a region. So this is knowing that when you go down, you go over that ridge, there's an area with no trees, and then below that, the tree line starts again, and if you go south at that point, you'll get to a watering hole. You know, that kind of thing. You don't necessarily know. You can't really draw it on a map necessarily very accurately, but you know how to do it, right? And so it's said that people who live locally in an area may have excellent root knowledge, like way better than somebody who's only looked at a map, but they may not have very good cognitive knowledge about how far things are or, you know, the actual relative placement of things. So I figured that in Buddhist practice, this can be analogized to what are called pariyatti and patipatti, which are two different kinds of knowledge about our practice. And the first, I know you may not know those Pali words, so the first pariyatti is about knowing the teachings. So maybe you've read the suttas or you've read Dharma books. You know, you can name the 8 steps of the Eightfold Path. That's good. And, you know, you can name the 4 Noble Truths, and you have an understanding, maybe a little bit of Buddhist history if you read about that. I'm just naming components of this, not that you would have all of those necessarily. And this is useful knowledge, actually. It is important to have a sense of what the main teachings are that we do. That's why we come to talks like this, and maybe why we read and so forth. And then the other kind of knowledge, this is something like survey knowledge, yeah. And then the other kind of knowledge is patipatti, which means knowledge that comes from doing the practice. So from logging time on the cushion, you start to understand, oh, I realize that my mind is of the sloth and torpor type most often, and these are the techniques that work well for me to not fall asleep when I'm sitting, and so forth. These are very practical things, and you may not be aware that there are 5 hindrances, and sloth and torpor is one of them. It doesn't matter. You know how to work with your own mind. Yeah. So these are kind of different ways. Now, we're actually encouraged to develop both. So, for example, when learning a skill, like playing the piano, it's important both to study the scales and the keys and the signatures and so forth so that you can read music, but then, and maybe something about phrasing and melody. But that's not that useful if you don't actually play the piano. So you have to actually also put in the time where you sound horrible and you miss all the flats and sharps, and you know, and you have to actually practice it and sit down and do it. And then you start getting the body memory, you start getting the intuitive sense. It takes a while, but we know this feeling, right? When the competence through the body and the mind starts to develop, and that's like the competence of sitting on the cushion and knowing how to calm the body and the mind and how to observe what's going on in experience. It's possible to do just one. That's actually okay, but maybe the most complete knowledge comes from both. This is actually, I gave the music example because this fits my own experience with music, is that I started playing music when I was a child, and so I didn't really learn much of the theory. I was just taught, you know, how to read music, and I played a lot of several different instruments. And I actually, for some reason, was never interested in music theory, and I played in many different music groups for about 20 years. And at some point, I picked up a book, I think at a garage sale, just called Music Theory. It was maybe an old textbook or something. And I started reading it, and I thought, oh my gosh, I've been missing something really important. And I learned about like how the scales, you know, go in a circle and all these different things that I didn't really know. But when I started reading it abstractly, I could fit it into my own experience. And it did help. I mean, I wouldn't say I was instantly a better player, but there was just that a little bit more integration, I would say, of what, you know, what I had just been doing through playing all those years. And so, of course, it's the same in our mind. We can read Dharma books. We can attend talks like this one, and these are important. And we have to sit on the cushion and look at our own mind. That's why we do both on mornings like this, yeah? So we start to learn the roots, the root knowledge of our mental habits, of how our mind gets caught, how it gets uncaught. So it's helpful. And maybe I'll add one more thing, which is that it is helpful to have kind of one system that you stick with for a while. So it's not that helpful to dibble and dabble in this and that and do, you know, a year of this and 6 months of that. You may need to do that a little bit at the beginning to find kind of what resonates the most, but to get the, you know, the sort of deepest knowledge of a territory, you have to walk that route several times. You have to really look around and really pay attention. And it helps to stick with one tradition or one teacher for a while if you're going to go deeper in spiritual practice, settle on one system and learn it. Okay, so overestimating competence. It's found in studies of lost people that people consistently overestimate their understanding of where they are and how to reorient. Yeah? So their mental maps tend to actually be really incomplete and inaccurate based on only a little bit of data, but they're really sure that just over the next ridge they're going to see that tree that they know how to orient through. And it turned out that the people who were especially overconfident were the most vulnerable to getting turned around unexpectedly out in the woods. Yeah? So I think in our practice, we can be humble, a little bit humble about our spiritual knowledge. We can hear a lot of teachings and think that we get it. We hear lots and lots of teachings in the Bay Area. We may not realize quite how fortunate we are that, you know, on a given Saturday, there's probably 3 Dharma things that you want to do, right? And you can't do all of them. So we have, I think, all the information that we need. That's a bold statement, but I think many of us have all the information that we need. But we may not have really gotten to the bottom of it yet, because that's a sort of a longer-term process. We may have a somewhat intellectual understanding. So just be aware of that. We can also have powerful meditation experiences and think that we get it because of that. But the Buddha points out that, you know, there's no particular experience that is going to do it. It's actually a different kind of knowledge, you know, the ability to let go again and again. So we may not have really integrated things completely in our practice. So I really like the Zen idea of beginner's mind and remaining a lifelong student of the heart as we continue with our practice. One skill that is very helpful in the woods that they talked about as sort of a one more kind of knowledge is what's called meta-knowledge. And, you know, that's M-E-T-A. In our practice, we might say M-E-T-T-A also, but I'm talking about meta-knowledge, like the ability to know what we know and what we don't know. So this is kind of related. It's a It's an aspect of wisdom, and it develops on the practice, on the path, that we become a little bit wise about our own navigation, like what else we need to do, what we might need to look at next, what's coming up that's where we're caught and is the next place that would be important to let go. We don't need to have it formulated as a grand plan. It's actually kind of more, you know, step by step as it goes along, but we gain some wisdom about how to deal with the next thing that comes up. And people who don't have this don't know when they're employing a strategy that's not working, and they don't know when to let go of a strategy that has already worked and is done, and it's time to move on to the next thing. Both of those are important in our practice. The Buddha said, don't keep carrying the raft after you get to the other side of the river. So, you know, you're still put it on your back and carry it along. You don't need it. You can leave it by the river. When you get to the next river, you'll build another one, find another one, something. Yeah. So this is part of the wisdom of our practice, is to know when we're doing things that work and when we're doing things that don't. So this is honed in our practice by contact with spiritual teachers, participation in spiritual community, like we are fortunate enough to have here. This is important so that we can become more accurate judges and our own teacher, in a sense, our own internal teacher. So getting lost is expected at various times in our practice. And the question is, when a person discovers that they're lost, what means do they employ to reorient? So we've talked about a few of them, but this article lists in the woods a number of ways that people use. There have been strategies documented, you know, 9 or 10 of them or something. I won't read them all, but some are more effective than others, and they include random wandering, going in a single direction, climbing a hill or a tree to gain perspective, and sitting still and staying put and waiting for the rescue party. There's other ones, too. These are in the woods, okay? So the Buddha said that there are two responses that humans usually have to suffering, which we might analogize to being lost, and they are confusion or search. And so this means either wandering without focus or a plan, kind of like what I did for part of my life, or else looking for something that will help us, you know, initiating a search, what's going to help. Most of the ineffective strategies in the woods have to do with randomness, with sticking with something that doesn't work, or with relying on what's called folk wisdom that's completely wrong. They gave some examples of that, like, I don't even remember, one of them was orienting toward your birth direction by figuring out which arm is stronger or weaker when you face in different directions, and then once you're oriented towards your birth direction, you're supposed to be the clearest and be able to find your way. Okay, so that's an example of folk wisdom. You know, we have other things in our spiritual world, right, that we might be using. So, you know, wandering around. So this is sort of the equivalent of wandering around in the spiritual world without much direction or relying on a fixed view. I'm going to do it this way, and that's got to work. Well, maybe not. Or, you know, so we should look for the more effective strategies. And one of the strategies that is sometimes effective in the woods is this view enhancement, climbing to a ridge or a hill or up a tree in order to find a landmark that is familiar. You know, you get up high and then you can see where the road is, something like that. So similarly, we can do that in our spiritual practice by stepping back from our situation. You know, if we're really caught in something, the Buddha recommends mindfulness, recommends equanimity. Step back, have a look, don't immediately react and jump at something. Calmly assess where you are. And then before lunging in some direction, decide if it has some reasonable basis. And I find that this can be true just by kind of feeling into my heart and, you know, really sensing, does this seem effective? And then you can take a few steps in that direction, see if it feels like it's still working. It's important to have this kind of, you know, when we know that we're lost, to have this kind of overview, this meta-knowledge of checking how things are going as we try to move toward the direction of less suffering. have a lot more here. All right. So let's skip to looking at what it means to be found or to know where you are, because that's the contrast, to know where you are, to know that you have a path. First of all, this comes with a sense of confidence. So this article actually talked about what do people feel like when they feel like they're found or they feel like they're not lost. You know, they don't have those two qualities of not knowing where they are and not having a means of reorienting. So there's a sense of confidence. We feel assured that we're on the right path, or at least that we have a path. And if we lose our exact location, we know we have ways of reorienting, ways of stepping back, ways of using something as a foundation, like our ethical values, our understanding of cause and effect, our understanding of the Four Noble Truths, something that we have as a reference point or as a refuge that we're using as our base. Secondly, foundness has a sense of clarity to it, or clear comprehension. When we look around at where we are, the image is clear, it's pretty accurate. We're not fooled by mirages of the mind. We're not fooled by chasing false ideas or views or things that aren't really accurate and true. And then intention. So there's a sense of, you know, following from our view, we have a sense of how to go about walking the path, how to navigate based on our reference points of non-harming. We've talked about that a number of times. A reference point of peace, of liberation, of moving toward less suffering. So when we're in this state of feeling like we're oriented, feeling like we know where we are, we're living in some kind of harmony. Even if our life is not perfect at that moment, because that's usually the case, we at least feel like we know how to move through it. And I would say that this is what is meant by the term right livelihood. Yeah? So this is another step on the path that is part of what we're using to orient. You know, we tend to think of right livelihood as being about our job, but I think it's really more about our whole way of living, and whether that's in alignment with our values, with our understanding, and with our spiritual goals or aims at that time. That would be right livelihood. So we can try to create a general atmosphere in our life that is nourishing, that is sustaining, that points us in the direction that we want to go. Very important part of the path. And then there's sharing the path. So you can look around at the people in this room. Every one of us is navigating through the woods, okay, in some way, probably. And there comes a point where we realize this about the other humans that we look around and see. And then we allow that knowledge to fill us. Every one of us is here in the woods. Sometimes we're lost, sometimes we're not. But we got that, you know, and we're finding our own path in some way. And that can bring feelings of compassion, of joy, of love, you know, of connection with what we're all here doing together. Even people who aren't conceiving in the same way, because they're not here at IMC or even not walking a spiritual path, they're in the woods too. We got born as humans in this place. And so one of the gifts that we can give each other is to share our knowledge about how we have found and walked the path in various ways. And there's lots and lots of forms that that comes in. This is that quote that I read at the beginning. I saw an ancient path, an ancient road, traveled by the rightly self-awakened ones of former times. And what is it? Just this noble eightfold path. I followed that path. Following it, I came to direct knowledge of many things, and basically the Four Noble Truths. And then it goes on. Knowing that directly, I have revealed it to monks, nuns, male lay followers, and female lay followers, so that this spiritual life has become powerful, rich, detailed, well-populated, widespread, and proclaimed among celestial and human beings. So this is the Buddha speaking, but, you know, the Buddha was a teacher. His aim was to point out the path. His whole life, he was just pointing. So that beings could emerge from the state of being lost. Okay? And there are many ways to manifest and share our spiritual knowledge, and we'll each find our own way. We can talk with other people here at IMC. We can come to what are called the Dharma Practice Days, There's a new set of them starting this fall. Those are an opportunity to share with fellow practitioners about how we're understanding what we're doing as we're walking on the path. Acting ethically in the world is a way of sharing the path. You know, this is my orientation. This is how I act. We demonstrate that through our virtuous behavior. Remaining calm and present through our work life, our family life, our social life. If we can remain in a state of mindfulness, be calm, be compassionate, be present for people, that communicates also, this is the way I walk, this is the way I move through the world. Very powerful for people to see that. Thich Nhat Hanh pointed out that on the refugee boats that were coming from Vietnam, if only one person would remain calm, the whole boat had a much better chance of not panicking, not capsizing. Just one person out of a couple dozen, however many were there. There are also explicit actions we can do that share our path. So visiting the sick and the elderly, being with people who are in a state of suffering and sharing that with compassion. Social action in the world, helping people to remember the values that are important in society and to try to further those in some way. And even ordaining as a monastic, declaring that your life is about showing and walking the path and wearing the clothes and doing the actions that proclaim that moment to moment. So I hope for each of us that we'll all find the way to orient our life, to walk the path, and to share what we know with others. Thank you.